something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast.
Binge close to 100 episodes.
Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with the season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Ethnically Ambiguous, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, Anna.
Hey, Shireen. This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
This conversation went by so fast. It was so amazing. I'm so, so stoked that we have this guest on the podcast today. It's Franklin Leonard.
Yes, you might know him from The Blacklist, the founder, and you might know him from The Blacklist podcast, or previously The Blacklist Table Read podcast. Regardless, he's a great human being that we got on this show, and we're very excited to have him. We talk about his upbringing. We talk about how he even came up with the idea for The Blacklist and basically working in LA and all the different jobs he's had. It's a great discussion, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
It's an amazing conversation. Don't move.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hey, Shireen.
Hey, Anna.
How's it going?
How are you? Oh, God.
We've done it again.
I'm good, you know. I have a pulse today, so I can't complain. There's another remote recording. It's nice to see you. We've been talking through text, so it's nice to see your face.
Yeah, it is nice to see your face. And if anyone listening, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. We always forget to say this show title.
Oh, right.
Here we are.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for making us a part of your week, even in this crazy weird time. We really appreciate it. We're joined today by, I will full disclosure, a guest that I can't believe he's doing this podcast. but I'm very grateful he's doing it because I think he's an incredible person and I can't wait to share his story with you and to learn about it firsthand. We have Franklin Leonard with us today.
Hi, everybody. That is super flattering. Maybe like ease into it so people aren't expecting me to be better than I actually am.
Well, you're great. We want everyone to be excited.
Under promise, over deliver. Just like he's a decent guy. He might be interesting. And then by the end, hopefully people will be like, oh, that was incredible. I had no idea.
Well, okay, wait, we're going to edit all of that out. This guest is mediocre at best.
There we go. Mediocre at best. Franklin Leonard. The Franklin Leonard story.
Except for I refuse to accept that. Well, to give some background.
You got to manage expectations.
Yeah, well, we don't do that. We're very, we're in your face. Don't hold back.
Fair enough.
We've been, marginalized for too long. At this point, we're going 100 miles per hour at all times. Stopping us.
Yeah. Fair.
Foot on the pedal. On the pedal.
But just to give some background, how we got you on this show is one of my colleagues over at iHeartRadio, who's our head of content at the Big Money Players, and a guest we had on a few episodes back, Hansani. yeah. was like, hey, would you ever, I don't know, consider having one of my hosts on your show? And I was like, why are you acting as if I would say no? I was like, you don't have to, like, you know, I would love to. But that's kind of
I didn't know that was an option, to be honest.
Yeah.
If I knew it was an option, I would have asked a long time ago. I thought we were little fish in a big pond, but we're all just fish, it turns out.
Exactly.
And we're all just swimming. But yeah. let's just dive right into your life, I suppose.
I'm assuming
not everyone knows who you are. And so let's just meet you along with the rest of the audience. Tell us.
Hey. Sorry, my dog just started barking out of nowhere.
Ace refuses to be left out of this podcast.
He's never barked before.
Mine's outside right now, but with my fiance, but I'm reasonably sure he would be barking under the same circumstances.
Oh, oh
my God,
barks,
adorable.
Hey, I've never heard Ace bark.
Oh my God.
What's going on?
That is an adorable dog, barking or no.
He's so cute.
So cute.
Go in the other room. Go.
Get lost, Ace.
Sorry about that. Sorry to interrupt. I've never had that happen before.
Animals love me.
It just had to happen with Franklin's episode, didn't it?
It's all good. Animals love me. I'm with it.
Okay, cool. That's probably why he was like, how come I'm not involved?
Exactly.
He was so excited. But okay, let's start with just tell the audience who you are, what you do, and then we can kind of backtrack and talk about how you got there.
My name is Franklin Leonard. I founded something called The Blacklist, and I currently run it. The Blacklist started as an annual survey of Hollywood's most liked unproduced screenplays, and we sort of built it up into a company, an organization that, in addition to running this annual survey of most liked scripts, we have a sort of two-sided online marketplace where writers from all over the world can get their work discovered by the industry. We run screenwriters labs. We have a podcast of our own on Luminary. And we also now produce movies and television. So, you know, we're an organization that thinks of our North Star as, you know, identifying and celebrating great screenplays and the people that write them. And really anything that falls under that general aegis, we will try to find ways to do it if it can be a tide that raises all boats.
Yeah,
so that's the overarching premise. Yeah, that's the manifesto. Yeah.
I mean, if you're in the industry, even if you're not in the industry, you've heard of The Blacklist. Like I, as a filmmaker, I'm obsessed with The Blacklist. So thank you so much for, I just feel honored to even talk to you, let alone have you on the show.
That's very, very kind.
I'm so fascinated with how you came to make it. So let's just start, let's like backtrack, let's rewind on your life a little bit. Where did you grow up? Where were you born? Yeah. What were you interested in as a kid?
Born in Honolulu, Hawaii, which is not terribly notable, except for the fact that, like, there weren't that many black people in Honolulu, Hawaii in 1978, and Barack Obama was one of the other ones. as was, randomly enough, former CEO of AOL Time Warner, Dick Parsons.
Oh.
Because I think he was in law school at the University of Hawaii at the time. Anyway, so yeah, born there. My father was in the Army, so we moved around a lot when I was a kid. El Paso, Texas was our next destination, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. We lived in Germany for 3 years, sort of in and around Frankfurt, Ansbach, Heidelberg, wherever my dad was stationed. And then we moved to Columbus, Georgia, when I was about 8 years old. So that's like 2 hours south of Atlanta on the Alabama border, like deep south, which is actually where my dad is from. So he grew up there. His father grew up there. My grandfather's father was born a slave there. So that's very much like where my people come from, at least my dad's side. And then my mom's family is sort of from the Northeast and Chicago area. So that's where I'm from. What was I into as a kid? Math, mainly. I was a big nerd.
So you traveled a lot before, moved around a lot before 8 years old.
Before the age of eight, yeah. And then we just sort of stayed there. That became home. So I think of myself as being from Columbus, Georgia, but there's like this big chunk of my sort of adolescent autobiography that is defined by moving like every 12 months for 8 years.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I was basically Steve Urkel as a kid, like while Steve Urkel was on television. It was the worst.
Did everyone do impressions of Steve Urkel to you?
I mean, yes and no. I think it was more just like there was no need for the impression because I was basically Steve Urkel just like walking around, right?
So yeah.
I think I... you know, I remember when I met Jaleel and I posted a photo of us on Facebook, like literally every single person I had gone to high school with pretty much lost their minds. But no, look, I was a big nerd. I was, you know, super into the math team, quiz bowl. But I think my one saving grace was that I played soccer. But that was pretty much it. I was a big nerd.
Math.
Yeah. Man. How did that traveling and that adolescent phase, how did that influence you when you eventually settled down in that city? Was it easy for you to make friends, or did that kind of make you more inverted or like in like close to your chest or whatever? Yeah. Like, how did that play out?
We moved to Columbus when I was 8. I went to a public school for third grade. And then I went to like the one private school in my hometown. My mom got a teaching job there, teaching 6th and 8th grade science, so that she could get a tuition break for me and my two younger siblings. And we were one of a handful of black kids, but just kids of color, period, at this, you know, very small private school in the Deep South that happened to have come into existence right around the time of Brown v. Board of Education. So, you know, there were complicated racial and social realities, were complicated racial realities that informed the complicated social realities. So, you know, I had my little posse of fellow nerds who were in the context of this community disproportionately either white and really nerdy or of color and also nerdy. And like, those were my friends, you know. There was the half Pakistani kid whose, you know, dad was a doctor, a couple of Indian Americans. Kids, there was a Filipino girl who was part of our social group, right? It was, but like, we were definitely the outcasts, and we were outcasts because we were, by and large, not sort of white, but also very nerdy. And it was funny because we used to joke amongst ourselves that it wasn't really clear which thing made us the outcast, but the combination definitely made us the outcasts. And I used to joke sort of even beyond that, like, look, the only way my social reality would get worse growing up here is if I had been gay and like my best friend from like 5th to 8th grade before he went to boarding school was. And so it really didn't matter whether I was or not. But, you know, looking back on it, I'm really appreciative of those periods. You know, the people that I was close with, I'm still in contact with via social media and sort of text now. But I think it also defined for me, I think even now I naturally ally myself with underdogs because or outcasts or sort of people who are shunted outside of whatever the mainstream is. And I think it's because that's basically how I grew up. And even now, though I'm relatively successful, I work in Hollywood, like I have all of the markers of what would be considered, you know, putting me in the cool crowd. If you put me in any room, my default is always going to be like, okay, who are the people who are like on the edges here who are probably having the interesting conversation about everybody else? And like, that's where I will naturally find myself gravitating towards.
Wow. I relate to that so hard because I feel like when I got into this comedy industry, it was so much about like UCB and like all these like sketch school or like improv. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, if I don't do that, like I don't fit in. But it's like, but I've never fit in. So I might as well just carve that path out anyway. And
it's definitely hard. I mean, look, the other challenge, though, is that there are advantages to being part of that crowd, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, people don't want to be cool. They don't want to be part of the mainstream because it doesn't have advantages. And so there's a constant tension, I think, of wanting those privileges, and I use privileges very consciously, but then also like knowing that like that entire system is really complicated and pretty screwed up. So like, is there a way to fulfill what you want without having to sort of be a part of that system? Like, how do you manage the inner and the outer simultaneously? And I think that's been one of the things that has been one of the real challenges of my sort of professional life, you know, since I left the South.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I feel that so much. I'm an independent filmmaker and 100% have always felt like the underdog. I don't really, I have no family in the industry. Moved to LA and everyone, not everyone, but you encounter so many people that just have a leg up, have an advantage. They're connected. They have something that you don't. And I think now that I'm thinking about it for the first time this way, but because I've always felt like an underdog in my life, and I did gravitate towards friends that were also different and strange. I was the only Syrian in my school, other than my sister. So I definitely think that influences your mentality of yourself. Like, you view yourself as the underdog regardless of your career. And I think going into a career that also has such a huge difference, if you're an independent filmmaker, or if you're this idea of the, I don't know, just being othered and being the underdog kind of go hand in hand. So that's just, it really resonated.
But it's interesting, right? Yeah. Because there's a certain point at which that's not like, can I claim to be an outsider anymore? Probably not. Right. Like, you know, I'm invited to movie premieres and cool parties. And I my actual like real life friends are like making big Hollywood studio movies. Like, I have all the access in the world. Am I an outsider? No, not really. Do I still identify with outsiders? Absolutely. So the real challenge then is, once you gain access to the insider-y world, do you sort of disappear into that universe and that ecosystem and you're like waving at the outsiders from the outside? Or are you trying to, you know, brick by brick remove the barrier between the two? Are you trying to, like, you know, open windows and sort of flag everybody on the outside and be like, y'all at midnight jump through here, right? Like, how do you manage manage that tension? I think it's a challenge, and I think that it's a really exciting one. It's the thing that I find most interesting about the work that I do, is like, how do you, without sacrificing, you know, your values, mm-hmm. how do you transform systems that allow people who've historically been excluded from them to participate as full members of them?
I feel like I'm constantly trying to figure that out. Ever since I got hired at iHeartRadio bought our How Stuff Works, which is where we were originally working. It's like I got brought into this comedy vertical. And it's the whole time, it's like, well, now I have power and I can bring in more people of color. Like, I just got to do it. Like, it's like I should just do it and not let myself be like, oh, well, you know, now that I've got here, I might as well just do what everyone else wants me to
do. Right. But on some level, right, that's like the expectation is, okay, they let you in, but your job is not to bring in more people. Or even if they say your job is to bring in more people, they're like, whoa, that's too many people. We're not. Those people, right? And look, I think that there's two sort of things happening simultaneously. One, I just think there's this phenomenon happening where people are starting to realize that, like, because those of us who've been outsiders were outsiders for so long, we've been forced to sort of, you know, be twice as good to get half as far. Mm-hmm. But I also think on top of that, there's this sort of weird phenomenon where, like, we are almost by default what's interesting.
Right.
Because of our sort of external experience, like, you look at Mindy Kaling's show being number one on Netflix over Extraction, or Joe Robert Cole's movie being, mm-hmm. I think, number three right alongside Extraction at like 1/10 the budget. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. But I think that's a good point. The fact that, I mean, me and Anna were talking a lot about Mindy Kaling's show this weekend, just the idea that it's doing so well because it resonates with so many people. And me and Anna, I'm 30, Anna's almost 30. Like, this show isn't depicting us at this current age, but if I can only imagine watching that show as a young girl, like, how mm-hmm. I needed that show. I needed something like this show, even though I'm not Indian, I'm not Hindu, but when you're so misrepresented and have no representation at all, you grasp for anything you can.
Take what you can get, for sure. Yeah. Look, I was happy with Urkel. No one should be happy being represented that way. It's not a good look.
Yeah. Well, okay, I want to bridge the gap between you being in high school, making, like, being like a, I don't know, like a weirdo. Like, I see I see that word as a good thing, in my opinion.
Oh, 100%.
And then to where you are now.
Yeah.
So you are in high school, you're graduated. Mm-hmm. Do you know what you want to study? Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do?
So I got into Harvard thinking that I was going to be a math major. You know, I was really good at math in high school, like, got into Harvard, just keep it going.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's
amazing. And then I got to my first math class at Harvard and I looked around and I recognized the kid who had won the then Westinghouse science competition and another kid who had been in the New York Times for proving Fermat's last theorem for N equals 3. He was 15. And I was like, oh, right. There's a big difference between being really good at math in Georgia and being really good at math at Harvard. It's roughly the difference between getting a Fields Medal someday. And so I very quickly decided, like, this is probably not what I should do. And I ended up majoring in, Harvard's got a degree called social studies, basically social and political theory, and then sort of applications of that. And sure enough, I was right. I mean, like the kid that I mentioned who'd won the Westinghouse science competition literally won the MacArthur Genius Grant 2 years ago for work that, like, a continuation of work he had begun in high school. Wow. So, and the other kid had, like, left after the first semester at Harvard to go to a postdoc math program at NYU. Like, I was definitely out of my depth. But yeah, so I majored in social studies. The day after graduation, I drove to Cincinnati, Ohio to help run a congressional campaign for a teaching assistant that I had in a class that I had taken my junior year. We lost that race, very close race. But that candidate, John Cranley, is now the mayor of Cincinnati. Oh. Yeah, and I think, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point. Like I knew that I was interested in politics. I knew that I was interested in storytelling. Like, my job on that campaign was very much communications and sort of ads and things like that. I had won a fellowship during my senior year of college to travel after graduation, but you had to go to one place. And so I chose Trinidad, which is where my mom's dad is from. So I went to Trinidad and wrote for the Guardian newspapers down there for about 6 months, got bored, which is, in retrospect, ridiculous because I was literally just spending my time on a beach with a laptop writing. The things you think you know when you're 21. And then so I moved to New York and I took a job that I've been offered also my senior year and deferred it for a year working at McKinsey & Company as a business analyst and was there for 2 years overlapping with 9/11. So, like, Whoa. It was a series of... this isn't working, try this new job. This isn't working, try this new job. This isn't working, try this new job. And then at McKinsey, it was interesting because I was surrounded by incredibly smart people. We were doing interesting work. It just wasn't work that I was interested in.
Right.
You know, and so I was miserable. And about a year after 9/11, my entire analyst class got laid off with 6 months severance. And, you know, a lot of people were devastated. There was a lot of, like, how am I going to get into Harvard Business School, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, did you guys not just hear the woman? Like, we're going to get 6 months of salary and healthcare and not have to come to work. Like, this is a godsend. Like, how is this not great news? And, you know, I ended up spending a lot of my time. I was sort of doing voluntary work and doing some consulting for a lot of arts nonprofits sort of downtown. But I also realized that I was spending almost all of my time either reading about the film industry or watching movies. And, you know, growing up a black kid in the Deep South, it was more realistic for me to be an astronaut and go to the moon because I was good at math and a decent athlete than it was that I would go to Hollywood and work in the film industry. And so I'd sort of reached a point where I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, but it was the middle of winter and New York was cold and LA wasn't. So I literally was like, you know what, let me just move out to LA for a month and just check it out. And I did that in March of 2003.
Yeah.
Got an interview with an agent at CAA the second day I was there, was offered the job 2 days after that, and I started the Monday following. And that was sort of my transition to LA and the film industry.
Wow.
Lots of false starts
That's
in my
incredible.
Career, but I think that was what I needed. I needed to know that these were things that I was not interested in doing before I could put them to bed and then try to find the thing that I was.
Right. And you got a desk job?
I mean, it's very inspiring.
Or like an assistant desk job, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I was I was Lloyd in Entourage.
Wow.
No, I was a secretary. You know, the woman that hired me, who's still a dear friend, I think of her like my older sister.
Yeah.
Her name was Rowena Arguelles. She was an agent in motion picture lit at CAA, still is, and was representing a lot of talent coming out of the festival space, making the transition into studio pictures. So, you know, when I first started, I think it was the first week of production of Patty Jenkins' movie Monster. Mm. And when I left,
Oh, wow.
You know, Charlize had just won the Oscar. Wow. You know, now Patty's directing Wonder Woman. You know, Rowena signed a very charismatic, energetic young Maori filmmaker when I was working for her. That guy just won an Oscar for writing Jojo Rabbit this year and, oh, wow. You know, is going to be directing a Star Wars movie. That's obviously Taika Waititi.
So
she has amazing taste. Yeah. And we just sort of immediately bonded over both being nerds, both being sort of grammar geeks. And so I had a really good experience as an assistant. Most people don't. And I don't know that I would have stuck around the industry if I hadn't had her as my first, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah.
You know.
She was welcoming you. She was kind.
All the above. Like, and had really high expectations for what her assistant would do. And the funny thing was it coming from McKinsey, sort of coming from the academic background that I did, and frankly, being a black guy in any professional environment, I knew that I had to basically try to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And so I think she appreciated the fact that, like, here was this kid who was going to go above and beyond to do a very good job. And I appreciated, like, oh, this person is, you know, super psyched about the good work that I do, but also that's the expectation. And then we're nerdy in a similar way. We just fit. And I think that's right. Why we're still friends, you know, 16 years later.
Yeah.
That's a great job to get, because, like, the desk seat, I mean, I remember when I first came to LA, like, that was like a coveted position. Like, to get on a desk of an agent was like, that's it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
You might actually make it somewhere. But then there's also, like, the kind of dark side of, like, well, you know, maybe you won't. Like, it's just kind of the industry of, like, it's
I applied to so many of those jobs. I had so many interviews at so many agencies. And I became an assistant for a director eventually. And was an assistant for so many years.
Yeah.
And I totally understand that, like, and I've talked to assistants myself, and it's rare to have a very good experience, as far as I can tell. It's unless you really have someone in your corner. And we're going to get more into this. Let's take a quick commercial break really fast, and we'll jump right back in. So yeah, don't go anywhere.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie lover friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
And we're back with Franklin. We were just talking about the experience of being an assistant, and my experiences weren't always great. I'm not gonna lie. I think I really wanted each time I was an assistant for a couple of people, but I was trying so hard to like form them into like a mentorship, and that just never happened. And yeah. because I so desperately wanted someone to like help me.
Yeah.
But then you just have to help yourself if that doesn't happen. It doesn't always work out the way you think it will.
I think that's right.
But yeah. But I'm glad you had a good experience. I'm really glad, because I think, especially as your first foray into Hollywood, it must have been, it must have made it less intimidating being like a newcomer if you had a good experience your first time doing something.
Yeah. I think I was very lucky. I mean, I definitely was very lucky that Rowena was my first boss. But I think I also was coming into the industry with a little bit different perspective than a lot of people who were coming in right after college, right? Like, I had worked a bunch of jobs. Mm-hmm. I had you know, helped run this congressional campaign with not a ton of money. Like, the campaign wasn't particularly well financed. And we had a lot of sort of local politicos who were, let's say, difficult to deal with, who were constantly giving us feedback on our work. You know, I had worked at McKinsey & Company. I was not uncomfortable with 80 to 100 hour weeks and bosses who expected a certain level of performance. So, you know, I think I would have been fine with any manner of boss, because it doesn't really stress me out all that much to have a boss that's not all the way there or that isn't terribly respectful. Right. I just don't believe that it's necessary to be that kind of boss. And I think that, you know, I'd rather work for people who treat other people with respect no matter what their station in life is, than people who, you know, mistake their temporary power in an industry for anything other than exactly that. Because fundamentally it's irrelevant, like, to the way that we interact and treat each other as human beings, or should be, at least.
Yeah, 100%.
Moving to LA and like working those jobs like made me learn that, like, well, one, it I was like, you know what, I just have to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And then two, I was like, I never want to be the type of person that makes anyone feel less than just because I have my own insecurity, because I feel like I have to be a certain way so someone will respect me. It's like, no, I can just be nice. Like, I can just be pleasant to work with and try and help people around me. And
it's that stupid mentality of like, well, I had it rough, then you should struggle too. But I think it doesn't really work well with people of color or women, or like, it's not fair to hold them to that same kind of crazy, unnecessary thing, being like, well, I struggled, you should too. Because really, if you struggled and you got here and you're good, you should pave the way for other people. But I do want to circle back on something, because we were touching on how you jumped around so much from different careers and you were trying to find the right fit. I'm curious, when you started in this desk job and when you decided to go into Hollywood, to LA, did you have an idea in your mind, like, the career path you wanted, or in all these other careers, like, what was lacking in those careers that made you move on all the time?
Let's see. Politics, I got disillusioned.
Because it was so many different kinds of industries that you delved into.
No, absolutely. I think politics, I got disillusioned. I think I realized that I was a true believer, and so the stakes meant something to me, and I didn't know that I could sort of psychologically bear the frequent losses, because I knew the consequences of those losses, right? It's the same reason I didn't pursue medicine. I think that, the journalism thing, I think it was just lack of faith in my own ability as a writer, at that stage. And I think it's something that I still struggle with. You know, I've been doing more writing for publications. Like, I've written for Vanity Fair recently and the Washington Post editorial page. And there's still a deep-seated insecurity about one's own, output. You know, McKinsey just didn't feel like, I had any power to control what work I was doing. I was just assigned to projects and trying to help these companies make more money, and that felt kind of soulless to me. And it wasn't how I wanted to, if I was going to spend, you know, 80 to 100 hours a week, it wasn't necessarily how I wanted to spend my time. And then even within Hollywood, it's been a journey of sort of fine tuning, like, where exactly do I want to be? What exactly do I want to be doing, and what effect do I want it to have? And you're sort of constantly like adjusting, the frame, the focus until you get that, like, you know, left or right, I guess like an eye exam, left or right. And you're like, right. Okay. Well, this gives us this information and so on and so forth. So, but yeah, I think I just sort of kept trying things until they worked. It was an iterative process, and I never really worried about eventually figuring it out, even knowing that the figuring it out process was going to be painful.
Right. That's important, I think. I think why I'm so fascinated by that is that because you meet so many people that just like know what they're going to do. They have a 5-year plan. They know exactly what they want or whatever. Yeah. And it's a little bit comforting, to be honest, to hear you say that you kind of just went with whatever you felt at the time and you let yourself kind of figure it out as you went. And it's okay to switch in the middle of something, and it's okay to figure it out as, I don't know, just it's okay to keep evolving and letting yourself go to what you, where you wanted. Were your parents at all concerned with the constant jumping around, or were they more just like, he's doing his thing, he got this?
I think they were amused and concerned. You know, look, I think my parents have all, I've always been sort of super independent. And I think my parents were always like, well, we don't fully understand this decision, but we trust that you'll land on your feet, and we'll always be here. But we can't necessarily endorse your leaving McKinsey to go take a job as essentially a secretary and cut your pay by 70%. Like, we're not a fan of that. I think even now, I think they're enormously proud of the work that the Blacklist has done, but I don't know that they could explain it if they needed to, right?
Yeah.
I think the older I get, the more, I would say, reverence and awe I have for my parents as parents, because it is no small thing to raise like 3 Black kids in the Deep South in the 80s and 90s and have us end up as we ended up. Like, you know, I'm doing what I'm doing. My younger brother is a literal former professional soccer player who is now an attending emergency room physician in an emergency room in Queens. And my sister is, you know, a mother of 2 who does work on Black and brown women's maternal mortality, right? Like, and that's, and that is all 3 of us are basically living our parents', you know, values and virtues. And it was, you know, you work hard, you treat people well, you make sure that your work has meaning. And, you know, I have friends who have kids now. My 2 siblings have kids, and I think about having kids soon myself one day. And it's like, how did they pull that off? Like, how did they keep us safe, teach us correctly or incorrectly that we could literally be whoever and whatever we wanted to be inside in a world that decidedly does not agree with that point of view? And make sure that we weren't so nakedly ambitious for ourselves that we forgot, you know, proverbially where we came from. And I think they really hit the trifecta on it, and it's really extraordinary. So yeah, shout out to my folks and my siblings, because in many ways, what I am and what I do in most ways wouldn't exist without them.
Right. So I'm curious, after you... How long did you say you worked as the assistant at CAA?
Yeah, I was there for exactly a year. And then I got a job as a junior executive at a production company at Paramount that John Goldwyn had just started.
Okay, so tell us, where did you go from there, and how did the idea of the Blacklist come about?
Yeah, so after a year, I started working as a junior executive at John Goldwyn's production company at Paramount. I was very quickly recruited over to Leonardo DiCaprio's production company, Appian Way, about 6 months after that. So by November, I was working there by November 2004. By November 2005, I had had a year of experience as a junior executive, and it became very clear to me that you know, my job was to find great scripts and great material to turn into movies. Most of the things that I was reading fell in the category of mediocre to bad, because writing a great script is not an easy thing to do, which is why we should compensate people who do that better than we currently do. Mm-hmm. But my job was to find this stuff. So one of 2 things was happening. Either I was bad at my job, which was finding great scripts, or the job was, in truth, reading bad scripts and passing on them. In which case, my mother's weekly phone calls asking me if my LSAT scores were still valid was something that I should probably take more seriously.
Yeah.
I really did not want to go to law school, yeah. to be clear.
We know, Franklin. I'm sure.
I feel like probably every guest that you guys have on has... Yeah. I mean, look, it's funny because I'm now the only member of my family that doesn't have a graduate degree, and mm-hmm. it's very much the opposite of what everybody expected. And I think my parents still hold out hope that I think my best bet now is like an honorary PhD at some point, or like an honorary MFA. But like, if someone wants to make my mother really happy, give me an honorary graduate degree. Yeah. I will show up at your graduation ceremony and do whatever you need me to do. Anyway, so yeah, I just needed to find a solution to this problem. Otherwise, I'd have to go to law school. Mm-hmm. And so I took a survey of my peers, literally everyone that I had breakfast, lunch, dinner, or drinks with that year, and said, send me a list of the top 10 screenplays that you've read this year that have not been that will not be in theaters by the end of this year. And in exchange, I'll send you the combined list. I did that anonymously. I slapped a quasi-subversive name on it, sent it out at the end of 2005, and didn't really think anything of it. It was literally just like, okay, here's a list of scripts. I'm going to get a bunch of these scripts. I'm going to take them on vacation with me and read them. These scripts are really good. And then I came back from vacation and checked my email, and this list had been forwarded back to me like hundreds of times.
Wow.
And I realized very quickly that I had accidentally created a thing, but I was also sure that this thing was probably going to get me run out of town. Because I was sort of like, this isn't a terribly original idea, surveying people about their favorite unproduced scripts. Mm-hmm. There must be some unwritten Hollywood rule that prevented people from doing this prior that I just didn't know. Mm-hmm. So it's only a matter of time before I get unmasked and then probably have to go to law school.
Wow. So did that happen?
No. Well, yes and no. So in June of that year, I got a phone call from an agent at then William Morris pitching me on a new client. And it was a standard pitch, except for the fact that he ended it by saying, hey, look, don't tell anybody, but I have it on really good authority that this is going to be the number one script on next year's blacklist. Which was like, huh, I'm not making another one of those. So what are you, like, you're just, you're using the speculative notion of your client script getting on this list that I know is not going to exist to sell me on your client. Clearly,
but he doesn't know that you were behind it.
No idea that I was behind it. He was just trying to sell his client, right?
Oh.
And he knew that.
Right. That's so interesting. That must have been so cool to be you in that moment.
Yeah. Like, cool. What? Surreal. You know, I think punk may have still been terrifying, on at that point. Yeah. I was just like, this is an Ashton Kutcher thing. Like, what is going on? But it was also this realization that, okay, this thing that I created had more value than I anticipated. So I should probably do it again. And I did it again that year. And the LA Times outed me as the person behind it. And, you know, I had a long conversation with my boss. I have no idea to this day. 15 years
really?
Later, still no. Yeah, 14 years later, still no.
Wow. Clue.
So, yeah. Crazy. And then, you know, the next year, Juno and Larson the Real Girl got nominated for Best Original Screenplay, and that was significant because they had been the number 2 and 3 scripts on the first list. And then all of a sudden, everyone was like, oh, if you make these weird scripts that everybody loves into movies, they make money and win awards. The only reasons I do anything are to make money and win awards. So, like, how do I, like, these scripts are important. Let me follow them. And that's really kind of been the case. You know, there have been 15 years of lists, about 1,200 scripts on them. A third have been produced. They've, you know, been nominated for 275 Oscars, 4 of the last 12 Best Pictures, 11 of the last 26 screenwriting Oscars. Wow. So, you know, we do a very good job of telling the industry ahead of time, like, hey, you should probably paying attention to this. It's very good.
Amazing.
That is really amazing. That's so crazy that you still don't know how. I really, that's a movie waiting to be made right there.
To this day, no clue how someone out.
Who's going to make this movie?
Someone out of
me. That's going to be the movie I write in quarantine, the movie of your life.
Blacklist origin script make it on the blacklist.
People have been joking about this for a very long time. I feel like no one should write that script. It will not be funny. And I mean, actually, it probably would be funny. I just think no one's going to make it. And anyway, don't write the Social Network version of the blacklist.
Social Network did well, though.
It did.
Well, who would play you in your version of you?
Oh, Lakeith Stanfield, 100%.
That's a good guess. Yeah.
100%. If I got to have one, and in fairness, you know, Lakeith basically played me at McKinsey and Sorry to Bother You. So I feel like, yeah, if ever there was someone that I would want to play me, Lakeith would be top of that list for sure.
Honestly, same though. I would want him to play me too. I'm kidding.
I think he can do anything. I think he is low key one of the most talented actors alive, and I'm looking forward to him getting the opportunities to do a bunch of stuff.
I feel the exact same way. He's incredible to watch and incredible to see him grow as an actor. I remember I saw him, the first time I saw him was in Short Term 12, way before he blew up. And I'm someone that after I watch a movie, I'll like really research it and want to know everything that went on to get to where it was. So I learned that like he didn't really have a lot of experience, that he was rapping, like that was his own kind of like expression. And I was just so consumed with this person. I was like, whoa, this guy is so fucking cool. And then to see him like gain success after seeing that little nugget of talent and like seeing it, like I don't know, it's just seeing that, I just love that whole adventure that he's on. But I'm really excited to see him eventually play you, so we'll look forward to that in the future.
Exactly.
Should we take another quick break and come back?
Let's do it.
All right, we'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie loving friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back.
And we're back.
With Franklin Leonard.
Yeah.
Of The Blacklist.
Yeah. Of The Blacklist.
Okay, after you heard back from this executive who's like, I think this is going to be on The Blacklist, like what... How did you like decide to make it official? Like, what were the next steps you took?
You know, I just decided to do it again. You know, there was it was a very informal process, and mm-hmm. the annual list remains a very informal process. It's just me surveying, you know, Hollywood gatekeepers about the things they love, but no one's made yet. And what's remarkable is that when you do that survey, you get a really interesting collection of scripts that are wildly ambitious and usually execute on that ambition. And even more excitingly, you get a bunch of movies that if you make them, make money, make a lot of money. So there was a Harvard Business School study last year that looked at the first 15 years of Blacklist and found that controlling for all other factors, movies that were made from scripts that were on the Blacklist make 90% more in revenue than movies that were made from scripts not on the Blacklist, which isn't because they were on the Blacklist. It happened because if you start with a great script, you have a better chance of making a great movie. And if you make a great movie, you have a better chance of making money on that movie. And everybody knows that. But, you know, the industry makes it very easy to focus on other things like what genre is it? Who's attached to star? You know, are the people starring in it of color or not? Right. But really what it comes down to is all anybody wants is a good story well told. And if you do that and make it responsibly, you can turn a profit on it across a large enough portfolio. But if you focus on the other things, you end up making less money, which is why it's like so hilarious to me when people are like, it's such an important ethical thing to focus on diversity. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it is, but it's also like a capitalist thing. Like if you want to make money, maybe make content that looks like your audience and you'll make more money. You know, imagine if like a toothpaste company only made toothpaste for white men, and then another toothpaste company came around and was like, we're going to make toothpaste for everybody. The company that makes toothpaste for everybody is going to make more money and sell more toothpaste. Like, it's very obvious. Narrative and storytelling is no different.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what the Blacklist did right. I think that it's cliche, but it like peeled back the curtain behind this like hidden industry, because you were a part of it and you had this inside scoop because you like read these scripts. But for someone like, I can imagine myself, like, if I was like 10 years earlier here and figuring out the Blacklist as a newbie, that would have been like the most exciting treasure trove of things. And I think you put those films into the hands of the would-be audience and the would-be filmmaker. So
yeah,
I think that's what it did right that people didn't really get before. Like it kind of made the illusion of, I don't know, it made it so accessible in a way that wasn't there previous. So I think that's what I really commend you for doing, maybe consciously or not, because I think when you're in the industry, it's hard to imagine yourself not in the industry and like the effect that could have. But yeah, that's why I think it did really right.
I'd be lying if I said that I knew that everything that has happened with the Blacklist would happen, right? I think some of the stuff I've been able to predict, and certainly having done it for longer, I'm like, oh, if we do this, this is how the town's going to respond, which will allow us to do that. It's a little bit of chess. What I will also say is that I had to catch up with what I had done, right? Like, I didn't fully appreciate the ways in which it would affect writers' careers being on this list that I had made. I didn't anticipate that the simple fact of its existence would inspire writers who were aspiring professional writers to write things that they would never have taken the risk on previously, because they're like, well, I may not get this weird movie made, but if I can get it on the Blacklist, I know that I can have a career. And that's been really gratifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's incredible. That's really incredible.
So earlier you said you guys have started, basically the Blacklist has grown. Can you talk a little about what you guys do now?
So there's the annual survey, which we've talked a lot about. And then we have a website. You can check us out at blacklist.com with no vowels and blacklist, blcklost.com. Basically we allow anybody on earth who's written an English language screenplay, you can upload it and host it on the site for a fee and pay for a reader, who we've hired to evaluate that script. You get feedback usually within 2 weeks, but definitely no more than three. If it takes longer than 3 weeks, you get a free month of hosting on the site. And then if the script is good, we will tell everybody in Hollywood, like in an automated way, like, hey, everybody, this is a really good script. You should do something with it. And then you get a bunch of free hosting and free reads. I won't belabor all the details, but it's on the website. On top of that, we now run three screenwriters labs every year, one for feature writers, of all genders, and then two labs for women specifically, with women in film, one for TV writers and one for feature writers. We do podcasts on Luminary. We do live script readings when we're allowed outside at the Montalban Theater here in Hollywood. We have a number of sort of additional lists of scripts that we've created with various affinity organizations. So we've done two GLAAD lists for scripts about the LGBTQ plus experience, two CAPE lists for Asian Pacific Islander writers. We just announced the Latinx episodic list in the last couple of weeks, and the fact that Hulu is intending to offer two blind deals to two of the writers that are on that list. We did a disability list with the Easter Seals and the Media Access Awards, you know, really just designed to partner with these organizations that are already working on narrative change and saying, okay, we can vouch for the quality of these scripts. You guys can vouch for that they're the kind of stories that you want to see from your community. And, you know, it sort of relieves the industry of the excuse of saying, we want to make things that are diverse. We just can't find the material. It's like, oh, here's a list right. of the material that's been validated by the blacklist, which you use to as an arbiter of taste on everything else. So that stuff. And then lastly, we're making movies now as producers. You know, like I said, the goal was to identify and celebrate great screenwriting. What better way is there to celebrate great screenwriting than to get the movie or television show made with the involvement of the writer? So the first film we executive produced was called Come As You Are. It's available on VOD now. It premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival last year and is currently a 97 on Rotten Tomatoes. And Questlove tweeted about it, which is pretty cool. And then our second film is called Breaking News in Yuba County, and we're just finishing up post on that, directed by Tate Taylor, who directed The Help and stars Allison Janney, Mila Kunis, Awkwafina, Regina Hall, Wanda Sykes, Ellen Barkin, Juliette Lewis, Matthew Modine. I'm forgetting somebody. I always forget somebody. But it's an amazing cast. And the writer, Amanda Adoko, is a 30-year-old Nigerian-American woman from the Bronx who happens to write like one of the Coen brothers. So it was a real honor to be able to get to be involved in making her movie. And yeah, and more soon.
I got to watch that Yuba County one. I grew up around there.
Yeah. It is not set in the Yuba County you're thinking. We took the name, but we had to reset it somewhere else. Well.
That's okay.
But yeah, it's a fun film.
Gotta check it out anyway. That sound great.
If you like Coen Brothers movies, you will love this movie.
I do like Coen Brothers movies.
I mean, like that's a crazy compliment to give someone. Like, it is, you, right? I believe it. Like it's a crazy compliment. But that's incredible. I think the fact that you starting this list anonymously has led you to this point that you're able to not only develop and make films, but you're also giving a platform to filmmakers that wasn't there before. How about you as a creative person? Do you do anything like outside of the blacklist for yourself? Are you working on anything like creatively on your own? What's that been like?
You know, I don't do enough creatively on my own. I think I tend to think of the work that we do with the blacklist as my creative work, right? Because I think as an entrepreneur, there is an inherent need for creativity and innovation. And then on top of that, a certain amount of discipline to make sure that the company will be carried off well. Over the last 7 years, it hasn't left me with a lot of bandwidth for other creative pursuits. That said, I've begun to noodle an idea for a book about the film industry generally and why it matters and who it matters for and the consequences of the historical failures that it's had. But who knows? I mean, I think I am creatively fulfilled by building this company and trying to get the movies made that we've tried to get made, but you know, we'll take it from there.
Nice. Well,
I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously you've done more than enough. I wasn't trying to be like, well, what else can you do?
give us more.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little about your podcast that you have?
Yeah. So the podcast, it started actually years ago. In 2014, we had a podcast with Earwolf where basically we took scripts from the website, cast them up with a bunch of actors and did table readings of those scripts, a bunch of amazing post-production work, and then put them out as essentially radio plays for the podcast generation. And we were one of the, you know, iTunes best podcasts of 2015. The Guardian called us one of the 10 best podcasts that's not Serial, because Serial was like thing back in the day. Right. So I guess top 11.
That was the only podcast,
I remember that era when like it was all anybody talked about, like period, full stop. It was like the last dance of its time. But so that died. And then we were lucky enough that Luminary came back and said, hey, we want to revive this, but we also want you, we think you're a pretty good interviewer. You and Kate Hagen, who's my colleague at The Blacklist, should, we'll do three interviews with talent, directors, actors, anybody, about the role that film has played in their lives, right? And then once every month, we'll do a table read as well. So that podcast launched literally the first week of the worldwide lockdown. So there have been no table reads because we can't really get actors in a room and have them record a table read. But so for right now, we've had just amazing interviews with Alan Yang and Paul Feig and Roxane Gay and Gabby Union is coming up, mm-hmm. right? Like, with amazing people about the role that film has played in their lives. And then we have sort of a Proust questionnaire that we weave throughout the interview so that everybody kind of gets asked the same questions. Like when was the first time you saw yourself in a movie? What was the first movie you remember seeing in a theater? What's your favorite movie about love and your favorite movie about war? What's the one movie that you would program for every human being on Earth if you could program a simultaneous screening? And it's been really interesting to see how people think about those questions differently, where there are commonalities, folks who have the same answer, but you would never expect it at all. Because again, I think that for me, the reason I work in film is that it is a medium that allows us to tell stories about what it means to be human to the largest number of people. And I think that there's a consequence of that, right? Like it's sort of unknowable and unquantifiable, but if a million people walk into a theater one weekend and come out of that theater having watched the movie, looking at the world and their fellow person a little bit differently than they did when they went in, that has an effect. And a million people is not a lot of people to see a feature film distributed in theaters in 2020, right? Like, Black Panther made $240 million opening weekend. That is roughly 30 million people looking at the world a little bit differently than they did when they went in. And so to the extent that we can tell stories that will make people see the world differently and then go back into their lives and behave differently, I think it's an incredibly powerful medium and incredibly important that we do the things that, you know, create images that aren't going to create a world that we don't want to be a part of. That was a long rant. I apologize.
No, that was great. That's what you're here for.
No, apologize. That's why you're here. Yeah. No, I think it's so powerful and so necessary. And so I would really... Wait, what's the podcast called and how do people find it?
It's called The Blacklist Podcast. You can find it only on Luminary, as they say. So yeah, if you join Luminary, we'll be right there. And the full catalog is there.
Perfect.
Enjoy.
The backlog from Earwolf is also on there.
I think the Earwolf stuff is not on there, but if you just Google The Blacklist Table Reads, which is the name of the original podcast, you should be able to find the backlog.
Okay. Cool, everyone. Nice. We'll do that, and I'll link everything in the description below. If you look down,
there
you'll
we go.
Find everything.
Yeah, there, and there's a link on the Blacklist website.
Everything will be linked.
We'll get you access to everything.
Great. Okay. Well, Thank you so much for doing this show. We really appreciated you taking the time.
It is an absolute pleasure.
You're an important person in this world, especially for people of color and anyone
really,
who feels
really
marginalized.
Are.
I know it's hard to take any compliment, but you know the work you're doing is huge for us.
Look, it's very flattering, so thank you. Two, I think part of it for me and part of the reason why I struggle to sort of accept the compliment is that I'm acutely aware of all of the other things that we could be doing in a similar direction. And I'm acutely aware of the stuff that we haven't yet succeeded in doing in that direction. So as happy as I am with what we, the team at The Blacklist have done, I really do hope it's just the tip of the spear. And so, you know, let's check in like 10 years and see. See how we're feeling.
Sounds good.
We'll have you back on in 10 years and we'll revisit this conversation. The fact that you have that drive makes me excited to see what you guys do next, because you aren't complacent and you aren't just like, we've helped so many people, this is what we're doing, whatever. I'm inspired and excited about the idea of seeing what you're able to do next based on what you're able to do right now and what The Blacklist originated as. I think that's just... I'm really looking forward to it.
I think that is reasonable praise. That I can accept. we think what you've done so far is dope. We're excited to see what you do next. Let's see what happens. And I will focus on making sure that I deserve that praise and do things that follow it up that merit your faith in whatever I do next being exciting.
Perfect.
Thank you. Thank you for accepting my
I'm not good at this stuff.
Where can people follow you?
Yeah, plug in all your things.
I'm on Twitter at Franklin Leonard. I'm at Instagram at Franklin J. Leonard. The Blacklist on both is the THEBLCKLST. Yeah, that's pretty much where to find me.
Perfect.
Awesome.
Go follow him. Go listen to other shows.
Again, thank you so much for being here. Listen to The Blacklist. Follow The Blacklist. Read some good scripts. We all have the time. If you're not working. If you are working, thank you so much. You are heroes. But this is Ethnically Ambiguous. You can follow us at Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm just at Anna Hosney on Twitter. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you so much.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Stephanie J. Block.
And I'm Mary Lee Fairbanks.
And we host Stages Podcast.
Binge close to 100 episodes.
Hear the inside stories from backstage and behind the scenes as we go beyond the resume and into the heart of creativity and what it really takes to be in the business of show business.
Don't miss our chats with this season's Tony nominees. If you love theater and entertainment, you are going to love Stages Podcast.
Subscribe to Stages Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts and visit us at stagespodcast.net.
Every week on Talk Easy with Sam Fragoso, I invite an artist, writer, or politician to come to the table and speak from the heart in ways you probably haven't heard from them before. Some of my favorites are with Tom Hanks, Questlove, and Cate Blanchett. In recent weeks, I talked to actor Dan Levy, director Ava DuVernay, and the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. You can listen to Talk Easy on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.